You are listening to Secret Handshake, the podcast covering the movies that help you identify your friends and maybe make a few more along the way. Coming up, another installment in our mini-series on the films of the Brat Pack, starring Emilio Estevez, featuring cowboys, punks, cops, peeping toms, aliens, outlaws, juvenile delinquents, hockey, garbage men, repo men, regulators, and Richard Dreyfuss. Martin.
Yes.
I was like, Emilio! Welcome back to another edition of Secret Handshake. I'm your host, Jacob Knight, and joining me as always is Martin Carlson. Martin, we doing more Brat Pack, baby.
I'm excited.
Now, here's the thing, though. Emilio Estevez, and this is how I'm going to start it, is he the most boring actor of this entire Brat Pack group?
One of the most successful of the group, and also, we've watched so many other, obviously, many episodes for this podcast of new appreciation for certain filmmakers and actors. Yeah. This was the opposite for me. Watching them in such close succession, I don't hate Emilio Estevez. I love a lot of his movies, but it doesn't add up to much.
That's kind of my point, is that it's almost like you can understand why he was so popular is because he was almost like vanilla pudding, because like, he tasted fine. He wasn't dangerous. He starred in movies that were pretty palatable. And you can see the ambition like behind them, especially behind one of the movies we're going to talk about that he directed. But in the end, he almost seemed like the safest. Like, he's not like Rob Lowe, who's getting into sex scandals and like having to reinvent himself, or even Andrew McCarthy, who was picking kind of weirdly dangerous material at times with like Bret Easton Ellis adaptations. Like, Emilio Estevez. Now, one of the movies we're going to talk about, which is also funny because I'll let you make the joke about stretching back however many years we've been doing this now, is that I kind of gagged about what I didn't want this podcast to be about. That's going to feature on this episode. But like, Emilio Estevez seemed like a guy in hindsight who knew what equated to stardom, especially in like the multiplex mainstream sense. But that didn't necessarily mean that any of his movies were that interesting.
No. Well, I mean, actually, a lot of the films we watched as like ancillary to this episode of you and I did our own. Actually, watched quite a few of the same ones of just extra homework for Emilio, and some of them are just like the definition of programmers, you know, of just they would be Netflix digitally shot movies today, maybe.
Like, let's get into it. Like, you have Young Guns, Wisdom, which he wrote and directed. And then Repo Man.
Our central three.
But we also are going to talk about Breakfast Club.
Stakeout.
And probably on your end, Mighty Ducks.
And Tex. Yeah.
But I mean, where do you want to start?
I mean, let's start Let's start with earlier. So I'll start with Repo Man, actually.
Sure.
And to call back to your earlier setup there, when we first did this podcast, this has been over 4 years now, and I remember us sitting together, and we were kind of talking about the thesis or like our mission statement behind Secret Handshake, and you're like, yeah, I just basically don't want it to be this other podcast where we talk about guys just talk about Repo Man sitting on a couch, and we're now on a couch
talking about Repo Man
with bottles of Modelo next to us.
And some Mezcal.
Mezcal being the most podcast dudes of all time. But the thing about Repo Man is, and I know we both agree about this, is ultimately one of my favorite movies. Maybe like the ultimate, it's a midnight movie. You know, it is that definition of like, I have seen it as a midnight movie at like on 35 when I used to know.
Sure.
And it's like, hey, we're showing Repo Man late, come in, have a beer. This is the definition of that. And also, this is what actually kindled my love of Alex Cox.
But at the same time, Repo Man is now showing as part of Draft House's Class of 1984 yep. series on DCP to a bunch of, like, basically people who never heard of Repo Man, never bought a Criterion Collection Blu-ray, never seen it on 35, never like watched it on tape with a bunch of their friends high on acid at midnight, which is yeah. how I basically first experienced the movie, is that like Repo Man in a weird way has gone from being one of the ultimate cult films to being part of the mainstream.
Yeah.
Which is strange for a movie that still to this fucking day, when you watch it, feels totally radical.
It's so wild. And like with Alex Cox, so again, like I think it was grad school where I had only seen Repo Man and I rewatched it and I just went down the rabbit hole of like from Straight to Hell, which is down to like the three businessmen, down yeah. to like Searchers 2.0, like his really weird digital stuff. And now he's at UC Boulder, basically making films with his students.
Yeah.
You know, shot on digital.
Do you ever watch Repo Girl?
I did not like it.
It is bad.
It's bad. But there was this era, and thankfully a couple years ago, and I think you went to some of these too, pre-COVID, they did the Alex Cox kind of retro at the Ritz downtown. Yeah. And I had never seen Highway Patrolman. That was the one I had never seen.
Yeah.
It's whatever. But like, it was cool to see it.
Well, here's the thing about Alex Cox. He's bad. Like, Repo Man, to me, is a fluke. I don't even really like Walker that much.
I love Walker.
Really?
It's one of my favorite. I love that movie. I've
tried so many times. Like, Alex Cox is one of those guys where I think he had one great movie inside of him, a lot of great ideas, but none of them actually congealed into a fluent movie.
Well, he was a guy. I mean, like, have you ever read X Films, his autobiography? Yeah. That's great. It's a great book, too. Even if you don't love his films or think he's.
Well, and also a bunch of his spaghetti Western critiques, too.
Like, yeah, I mean, he's
one of the ultimate kind of experts on that subgenre.
On that, and also just he's a full on movie brat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, he's a guy.
He's a genius.
He's in that sense. And he's a really great interview to watch. And that book, too, was like, he was also a guy who was just part of the scene.
Yeah.
You know, like, he was around. He's friends with Joe Strummer. He's friends with Iggy Pop. He was, like, part of this punk society. And, like, and a lot of times, you know, Repo Man is this confluence of all of these things of, like, the paranoia toward the government, just straight up, like, a mistrust of capitalism. You know, it's kind of like a senior's thesis film, but
sure.
done really, really well.
Yeah.
You know, but it's also like you have, again, Emilio Estevez, and the original person supposed to play this was Dick Rude, who was a creative partner of Alex Cox and who plays his best friend, plays Archie, right?
Yeah.
And there was a whole almost kind of fallout between Dick Rude and Alex Cox because he was supposed to play him. And they're like, well, it's Emilio Estevez, which is funny because one of the things you and I talked about a lot while we were both watching these together and separately for Emilio is is he the original Meppo baby in terms of the way that Hollywood saw him? And we talked about the Bratz documentary of the original interview that created the Brat Pack moniker was about Emilio,
right?
And it was kind of accusing him of being, without saying the word, Nepo baby.
Yeah, it's basically the whole early article that's written that Andrew McCarthy's documentary kind of dives into is that they're supposed to do a profile of Emilio Estevez on the eve of St. Elmo's Fire releasing. And it more or less is like, what is your lifestyle like? That's what it reads. Like,
yeah.
It's more of a lifestyle profile than an actual artist profile. You know, and it paints this group of folks who are all in St. Elmo's Fire, like Demi Moore, Emilio Estevez,
Rob Lowe,
Andrew McCarthy, Judd Nelson,
Ali Sheedy,
like the key core group, as almost being these sort of, not necessarily talentless, but like just pretty dilettantes who lucked into their positions. And Emilio Estevez is being sort of like the ringleader in a weird way.
And the ultimate version of that.
Yeah, because, and it's never explicitly stated, but it's implied, to your point, almost like, well, they kind of ride on his coattails because he's Martin Sheen's son.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, that's bullshit, number one. Because the article comes out, what, 15 or 16 days before St. Elmo's Fire even hits theaters and becomes a major success. But also, like, one of the major movies we're going to talk about here with Breakfast Club also comes out in 85.
Yeah.
And Breakfast Club, let's start there, beyond Repo Man. Breakfast Club, I revisited, is, to me, I'm not a John Hughes person, but Breakfast Club is like a legit masterpiece. Like, if there's a movie that makes you go back, especially as you get older, go back and rewatch and go, young people have feelings, young people are individuals, young people deserve consideration as human beings. Like, the Breakfast Club is that. It's almost the embodiment of Roger Ebert's central thesis behind film criticism, that movies are an empathy machine, is that it allows you to look inside of another person's brain and pick it apart and say, they are people too. And like, the Breakfast Club is almost essential viewing in a way, because it allows you to look at another person and try and understand why they exist.
This film should not work.
No, not at all.
And so you said, are not a huge John Hughes guy. I am, you know, and I connect my love of Hughes with my kind of just general obsession with still with 80s culture. And we talked, you know, mentioned the slashers again, of just like, I love a good hangout movie. And what's great about Hughes is, and we were talking last time about St. Elmo's Fire, which is a weird film.
Sure.
Because it feels like kind of sometimes like an alien writing about young people when compared to Hughes, because Hughes was like an anthropologist in his way of writing about teens, but also showing like how they interact with one another. And like you said, like these walls between them based on class and based on like, you know, social status.
But also, like, one of the only pushback I would give to you against St. Elmo's Fire being a movie made by aliens is that it's more or less like, so it's a strange kind of like push-pull between Joel Schumacher, who's one of the ultimate stylists, you know, and the story he's trying to tell, which is very much an embodiment of what 20-somethings and early 30-somethings were going through during the Reagan era is that everybody wanted to be this young master of the universe, Tom Wolfe kind of character, or Bret Easton Ellis character, as we kind of went into in the first episode of this miniseries. And then at the same time, in the same year, The Breakfast Club is John Hughes showing empathy for a generation of teenagers and saying, like, they deserve to be understood too. You know, it's like, what's cool about Estevez's career and the Brat Pack's career in general is that if you track, like, say, Francis Ford Coppola's The Outsiders, that's someone looking back on a time period that has been and being like, this is what youth culture was. Yeah. Versus
like Dazed and Confused or exactly, American Graffiti. Yeah.
Exactly. To where John Hughes, I think the thing that makes John Hughes so interesting and specific, despite my not even distaste, but just generally like, and not even apathy, I just, it's never quite hit me the same way it's hit other people. The thing that made John Hughes so, like, important to other folks is that he was doing it in the moment. He was like, this is what kids are like today. This is what they're listening to. This is what they're talking about. This is what they're feeling. And that was different from, say, like a Francis Ford Coppola casting, you know, all of these young stars from like Patrick Swayze to Tom Cruise to Rob Lowe to a lot of the individuals we're talking about right now, is that he was looking back to where John Hughes was saying right now, this is what's happening. But also, he's introducing characters like Paul Gleason's authority figure and having that amazing scene between him and Carl the janitor.
Yep.
Where they sit there and they talk about what they wanted to be when they were growing up. And that, to me, is the key scene to unlocking what The Breakfast Club is about, is that it's about how adults view teenagers or preteens or what have you, the youth, let's say, versus how they view themselves and losing sight of the fact that, like, we were all dumb fucking teenagers at one point, but that doesn't discount the feelings and the emotions that we had in that specific moment.
Well, I mean, he opens with the David Bowie quote.
You know, exactly.
They're quite aware of what they're going through.
With the glass breaking, too, yeah, which is such a great visual, like, motif for what's happening.
Well, this is probably top 20 favorite movie for me. I really, really love The Breakfast Club, and I've watched it a lot. And I love what you said about the scene between Carl and Paul Gleason's character. And Paul Gleason, an all-timer character.
He's so good in this movie.
And he's like William Atherton of that era, great at playing assholes. Both of them together in Die Hard, you know, like playing just these, like, you want to punch him. But he brings this humanity, that scene too, where he's kind
of
like,
oh, I hope that's not one of the hostages.
Or he says, though, in Breakfast Club, is like, these kids, basically, they betrayed me. You know, this generation has betrayed me. And Carl's like, dude, kids have always hated authority figures, you know? And what I think what I like about that scene as a key, looking back at it as, is the universality of that film. That it is very much about 80s teens, but there's a reason we go back to this movie almost 40 years fucking later, because the class system of high school and the class system of our lives exist in a very similar way of, like, the jocks, the nerds. Now, nerd culture has changed, but the way that people don't understand each other, you know, and I think the way that John Hughes is able to mix these amazing, like, almost campfire scenes of, like, connection between these characters and just, like, a kind of, like, an amazing plot that just, like, them, like, these moments of them trying to almost escape and, you know, everything with John Bender up in the crawl space, you know, above. And it's really entertaining and really funny. a banger fucking soundtrack. I mean, the ultimate Simple Minds. Yeah, the
Simple Minds soundtrack.
It's the final shot with the frozen hand in the air. I mean,
well, and Anthony classic. Michael Hall narrating the actual singular the essay that ties all the characters together is like, if you don't cry at the end of The Breakfast Club, I don't give a shit. You're not a human being.
Well, there's also like just, I mean, Ally Sheedy's character in particular, the line that I think of, it's been memed and also used in even modern music, like when you grow up, your heart dies, you know.
Yeah.
And again, like you said, this is a film I watched when I was first in middle school, where I was younger than these people. Now I'm 40. I'm 25 years older than some of the characters in this movie, and it is this thing of like, have I betrayed my dreams? Have I betrayed the person I said I was going to be? Like Carl and Paul Gleason are talking about it, if I give it up on like what I said I was going to be when I was 15.
Sure. My thing is that, speaking as somebody who works with young people who are half my age,
and I honestly do too. Yeah.
You know, and you do too.
Yeah.
The thing that I took away from it this time is that youth is almost like clothes in a dryer, is that the residue of what came before is always clinging to you and tumbling over and over again, and you're never going to lose that, but it's always good to sometimes pull those clothes out of the dryer and rewear them because you remember how they fit. Like, every time you watch The Breakfast Club, it reconnects you with the idea that you were these people too once, and you can't deny that they're human beings. As sometimes you might look at them as you get older and be like, well, their ideas about the past or the present or the future might be silly, or that you might think that like them listening to, you know, Espresso might be a silly song that you never like, but you liked something
stupid
when you
as fuck.
Were just as dumb when you were growing up. And like, it's good to remember that, like, sometimes those things just make you feel good in the moment. No matter what age you are, you have to like revisit that moment in time and reconnect with that just in order to feel human again and remember that, like, because it's so easy to lose sight of the fact as you get older that you experienced in your own way the same thing that these people are experiencing too. Like, there's still, I don't 100% agree with you that the movie's perfect, because I feel like there almost should be 10 more minutes to it. Mm. Because especially in the third act, is that like the big thing is that it spends so much time, particularly in Act 1 and 2 with Bender's character.
Yeah.
It's almost like a black box play taking place inside of this library where all these kids are in detention. And Bender is almost like your main character. He's almost like your Hamlet.
Yeah.
In that he's just monologuing.
He's your catalyst, too.
Exactly. Yeah. He's just monologuing the entire time. And yeah, he's the catalyst. He's pulling all of these other feelings because he's the only one who's like truly confrontational out of the central characters. But by the end, there's one bad thing, is because you have the best scene in the movie is when they all get high and they're sitting in the circle and they essentially confess to one another about what's happening in their interior lives.
They're like dark secrets.
Especially Anthony Michael Hall talking about the gun in the locker and how it wasn't a gun. Because
it's a flare gun.
The interesting thing is that it's like, when you watch it, I wonder how it was watching it almost 40 years ago now versus watching it for like in 2024. And that when you watch that scene and he talks about having the gun in his locker, I question whether or not he, like they all interpret, the characters do, is that he's going to kill himself.
Yep.
because he failed shop. But if you were to make that movie today and have that monologue, you would wonder if he's going to be a Dylan Klebold and kill the teacher.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And some students. And just being an outcast in his...
Exactly.
His yeah.
Like, it just... It plays differently because even though those clothes have run through the dryer, they've changed shape. They've shrunken. They've grown... Like, it's just... They feel totally different now because our culture has changed, even though the themes remain the same.
Well, it's... You know, I had a friend too, my friend Steve, I went to film school with, and like, we were talking about John Hughes, and he's like, I don't like Ferris Bueller. And
yeah, because he's a big fucking privileged cocksucker.
Because he's the definition, like you said, of Reaganomics. It's this guy of getting away with it. Like, it was the definition of that 80s.
Well, it's like the thing we'll get into when we do the John Cryer episode is like, Ducky has aged incredibly poor.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, and there's some stuff in this episode, too, of just, like, of... And privilege, I think, is the number one thing that I think separates a lot beyond the very obvious stuff of, like, Revenge of the Nerds. Like, we can't do things like that anymore when it comes to sexual violence.
Or the black gay character.
Yeah. It's
can't do that.
Yeah. But in particular, I think...
Or like, Animal House is the other one, too, is that you watch that now and you go, ugh.
Well, there is something about, you know, a lot of these films have these very privileged people, you know, and besides Bender in this film and Ally Sheedy's character... is Allison, like, the other three come from money. Like, it's pretty clear. Specifically Molly Ringwald, but I mean, even Brian, the Anthony Michael Hall character, it doesn't seem like a money thing for him. It's more like a kind of nerdy social class within, like, the strata of high school.
Well, I think one of the details, and it's funny because Breakfast Club wasn't one of the three movies we picked, but we're just diving into it
so
hard.
You can't not.
But it's such a great touchstone. Like, I remember when Criterion released this movie and people really pushed back about it, being like, why would this be a Criterion Collection selection? And you watch it and you're like, why wouldn't it be? This is like one of the key American pieces of cinema of the 80s. Like, if you want to see what 1980s American high school life was like, you watch The Breakfast Club.
Well, this is it. Like, this is the one.
Yeah.
Like, if you had to pick one.
Yeah.
Like, maybe this and Pretty in Pink as, like, a close second.
Exactly.
Also written by Hughes.
16 Candles.
Yeah, all Hughes.
All the Hughes stuff.
Yeah.
But, like, one of the key things I would point out, and I think he does a great job visually, is that it's a small detail that I picked up on over time, and especially when you're in your 40s, but like the cars that all of the adults drive that drop them off to detention, is that like Molly Ringwald's father, who drops her off, is driving a BMW.
Yeah.
Now Brian's is kind of like a small sedan. Now, and that's where I would push back against the idea that Brian comes from money. I don't think Brian comes from money. I think his parents are working class people who do okay, but they want their kid. That's why the grades are such a big
pressure.
Thing.
Yeah.
And it's one of the details about that character that he maybe doesn't realize in the moment of his youth, is that they want you to get a scholarship and get the highest GPA possible, and you can't get the F in shop because they drive a used sedan and drop you off to detention in that vehicle because they can't afford that. If you don't get that, you're going to state school. You're not going to Harvard. You're not going to MIT. You're not going to any of these. You're going to U of I.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, and that's fair. And I guess
Bender walks.
I guess I just mean, like, there is still this, like, watching it today, it's also, like, five white kids. You know, like,
No. Well, I mean, that's the biggest criticism of Hughes's movies in general by a lot of people in kind of modern day and modern criticism, is that it's, like, There's no black people.
Yeah.
There's no Indian people. There's no Chinese. Well, there are Chinese people with Long Duk Dong, and that's going to be a conversation we'll have down the road when we go into that movie.
Yeah.
But, like, his treatment of people of color is either non-existent or kind of jokey.
Yeah.
And looking back on it, you go, ugh.
Yeah.
And, like, especially for Chicago, because if you've ever been to Chicago, obviously,
pretty diverse
it
place.
Ain't all white.
Yeah.
You go to the South Side, I mean, you and I would be, let's say, the minorities at that point.
Yeah.
So, but speaking of weird privilege, do you want to talk about the fucking weirdness that is Wisdom that we watched together?
Okay, yes.
What a strange fucking film.
So Jacob had seen it, and you told me it's wild. And then we got back from, was the night we saw Oddity.
Right.
Was it Friday?
Yeah.
And you were...
Which is overrated, by the way. Oddity, overrated.
Yeah, it is.
Two stars.
But, three. But you were like, it's really hard to find, and you had it, and... You brought it over, and there's moments of this that are like room level, Neil Breen level of like,
it's deranged.
It's completely self. It's the one of the most self indulgent films I've seen in a long, long time. And you were like, I have one big issue with this movie, and I think you're gonna figure it out pretty quickly. And you had told me ahead of time, not to like steal your thunder, but like you're like, this is basically Emilio Estevez's Straight Time, which is, you know, for those who haven't seen it, an amazing...
Or Legend of Billie Jean.
Legend of Billie Jean. But, you know, for Straight Time, you know, Dustin Hoffman starring, Michael Mann written, really great, like, 70s kind of, like, low-intensity kind of crime drama. And...
Well, and also about a guy who's... been down on his luck, convicted of a crime, tries to re-enter society, and cannot catch a break.
Yeah.
More or less. And in Straight Time, the difference is Straight Time is written by Eddie Bunker. It's an adaptation of an actual criminal's novel. Where
and Michael Mann helped too, yeah.
is written and directed. Well, I mean, like, the novel comes
You're right,
from Eddie
sorry.
Bunker.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's more or less a memoir.
Yeah.
To where Wisdom is written and directed by Emilio Estevez. It's narrated and stars Emilio Estevez, who is the son of Martin Sheen, one of the great movie stars of the 70s with Badlands and Apocalypse Now. And who would go on to be in The Dead Zone and The West Wing as President Bartlett. Like, he's an icon. And obviously, Emilio wasn't hurting for money. He wasn't like Eddie Bunker, who's basically like scrapping in the streets like a junkyard dog. You know what I mean? So, like, Wisdom, where his main character is a kid who on graduation night decides to get fucked up and steal somebody's, like, Thunderbird or something,
wrecks
it, and gets 4 years of probation. Doesn't go to fucking jail, mind you. He just gets probation. And then the entire thing is narrated like his life is ruined. He'll never get a job again. So he decides, because it's almost like Otto from Repo Man, but told ironically... to where he decides he's going to become a criminal.
Or told unironically.
Well, yeah. Well, no.
Sorry.
Like, Repo Man's the ironic version of this movie.
Yes, exactly.
To where it's like, he sees a video once, and it's about, and it's also like in a quarter machine, in a fucking train or bus station, that tells him about how the American working man is starving. So he decides to become a Robin Hood-style bank robber.
Who just burns mortgages.
Yeah, he goes from bank to bank across the country, robs them, but instead of taking money, burns the loan info.
Yeah.
while his girlfriend, who's played by Demi fucking Moore, by the way, eats tofutti
a lot
and acts as his getaway driver. And you watch this movie and you're like, what the fuck is going on in this? Because it's shot by Adam Greenberg,
yep,
who made The Terminator with James Cameron. It's edited by Michael Kahn.
For Spielberg.
Who's Spielberg's go-to editor. And it's scored by Danny motherfucking Elfman, including an Oingo Boingo end credits song.
Good song.
Which means he recruited his brother Bodie to do the end credits. Like, he basically uses all of his Nepo baby connections to make a movie about how he's one of the oppressed middle class and has to free the working man. It's deranged.
So there was a part we're watching this. You were on one couch, I'm lying down on the other, and I was like pissing. I was laughing so fucking hard. And you're like, dude, are you okay? I'm like, I, this shit is so...
You laughed at this harder than I thought you were going to. Like, I watched it by myself the first time in my living room, kind of stoned, and was like, and did the, like, one eyebrow cocked, like, dog face at the TV the whole time. Like, huh, what am I watching here? And then you had the better thesis about this movie, is that you almost feel like it's the response from Emilio Estevez to being more or less one of Hollywood's first great examples of a Nepo baby, because he even has, you know, Emilio's character in the movie has a difficult, to put it mildly, relationship with his father.
Tom Skerritt.
Who's played by Tom Skerritt, who rides him the entire time, and Emilio can't, like, live up to his expectations, and you wondered how much of that, and I don't mean to speak for you, but, like, how much of that was a projection of Emilio being like, oh, man, I really can't walk in my dad's, you know, famous footsteps.
Yeah, and again, the complete, utter irony of, you couldn't have made this movie without every fucking connection,
exactly,
that your dad has. Like,
especially all the car chases and shit.
Dude, there's this car chase. That one car chase has, like, full-on insane, like, Blues Brothers level.
When they flip that fucking car and it does a triple barrel roll,
and then
it's
one
insane.
One just gets literally split in half. It's like, or a pancaked into, like, this one piece.
It's awesome.
Well, and it's like, because it comes out of nowhere, and, like, it's, again, you know what it also reminds me of? Observe and Report. Because Jody Hill is the king of those delusional characters. This is an unironic version of it. No, but seriously, it's an unironic version
of
the same story.
That's the key
part.
That's
what I mean.
It's the unironic version. Because Jody Hill presents you with these characters who aren't self-aware.
Yeah.
Like,
completely delusional.
Kenny Powers doesn't, until the end, really realize what a fucking doofus he is. You know, Seth Rogen in Observe and Report, never once.
Nope.
He even is like, because that was the big kind of weird critique that divided people about that movie, is that you either thought it was a masterpiece or a piece of shit.
I think it's a masterpiece. But.
Because, oh, it is a masterpiece. There's no debating. It's one of the greatest movies ever made. But it's almost like if Travis Bickle was the hero.
Yeah.
You know, because it has the taxi driver ending, but, like, he's not deranged. He is, but he's vindicated at the end.
He just shoots the naked guy.
God damn.
It's the first
time. And he fucks Anna Faris.
While she's real drunk.
Oh.
Don't stop her.
When she loves him at the end. It's like, that movie's nuts, but, like, that's the joke. Wisdom is the guy who's like, what if, you know, I went around and was a folk hero for all of the common people, but, like, didn't realize that, like, he's kind of a dipshit the whole time.
Well, because you, I mean,
it even has the Peckinpah style Wild Bunch ending where he, spoiler alert, I guess, if you haven't seen Wisdom, which I'm assuming most of you haven't because it's kind of hard to see at this point, but, like, he gets fucking lit up by like the sheriffs at the end in like full on Wild Bunch style. And you're watching it like, what the fuck is happening in this movie right now? It's absolutely out of its fucking mind.
But it is, all themes and context aside, if you can watch this movie, I guarantee people who like the movies that we talk about,
you'll have a decent time.
You have a pretty good time. Like this
it's
is the kind
never
of,
boring.
This is the kind of thing though that I like back in Atlanta, the Plaza Theater would play at midnight. You know, where you got a
if
weird.
If Demi Moore were naked and eating tofutti, it would be 3 stars instead of 2.
Well, there's also a whole sequence of them because they're on the run, and it's just product placement. And like
it's
it
crazy.
Cuts, it cuts
absolutely,
and they hold up a Doritos bag, and she feeds him. He goes, like I'm not fucking making
I love
this
these
shit up.
Chips, baby.
It's fucking crazy. But this is like delightfully deranged. Honestly, I'd say Face Melter. I would in terms
no.
of it, no in terms of it being so bonkers, and for fans
it's debatable
for fans of Neil Breen it's basically
it's a little,
his Fateful Findings.
It's a little weirdly paced to be Face Melter.
It was
status.
Not a lot of action, but it's so. But again, it never
when it does kick up, it's worth it.
It's a curio, but you're like, holy fuck! Like I've never seen anything like this.
And then one of the other movies that we were talking about a lot offline that we both watched that we didn't even really assign each other, we just kind of stumbled on, was Stakeout.
Woo.
Stakeout is a, it's not good, but man, it's fascinating as an artifact
yeah,
of 80s action because like...
And buddy cop shit.
And buddy cop movies because like you watch it as the kind of filmic afterbirth that came following Walter Hill and 48 Hours. And, like, it's the after Beverly Hills Cop, which we just did, too, is that, like, the 80s were riding the high of the buddy cop formula. And 87 saw us get, like, Beverly Hills Cop 2, Lethal Weapon, and Stakeout. Stakeout being the worst.
Easily.
Easily. Of the three movies I just listed, but still watchable if way too long.
Well, and one of the things, again, back to our original kind of point of Emilio not being as great, is maybe we didn't remember just like watching him in such close succession. You're like, eh. And this film... Now, Richard Dreyfuss is playing out miscast, but Emilio is so unmemorable in this film.
Well, outside of his mustache.
But yeah, but
that mustache is dope.
But he's playing the straight man, and when we get to our next film, Young Guns, a lot of the characters he played, he was kind of doing this... The young
loose cannon.
Well, the young Kevin Costner thing from Silverado, right? Of just this like,
right.
Of like, I'm wild, but like, I'm kind of I'm the cute one, you know.
I'm the all American loose cannon.
Exactly, but everyone loves him. There he goes again. Watch out! And then
oh,
this
Billy
one,
the kid's just shooting motherfuckers
and
again.
It's like, Billy, you shot that guy. You can't do that. And this one is
regulators.
This is the opposite of that because he's all he is off. So the beginning of this film, I was actually really, really in because their relationship specific between Richard Dreyfuss and Emilio was dirty. I mean, like raunchy humor between these two cops. Who, like,
yeah.
Basically, the whole plot of them is they've been on a lot of stakeouts together. They're best friends, partners. They know how to like keep each other entertained. Of let's talk about movie facts or whatever. But
they've seen each other jacket.
But they just get. Really, like, there's a whole thing. Is like, he holds up. He's like, "Who's your favorite president?" And he holds up a fucking Playboy. And he's like, "Abe Lincoln." About like this, and you're like, "Oh my god!" I mean,
well,
it's
and
like
he unfolds a centerfold.
That's
in
what
that
it
scene,
is.
And he goes,
yeah,
"Abe Lincoln."
Yeah.
But like, what's weird about that movie is that it almost is the Rosetta Stone to decoding what about the 80s buddy cop movies actually works is that you have to have the right combination of talent that has the right chemistry together. Yep,
that's all it.
Because, you know, from Nick Nolte and Eddie Murphy on to Eddie Murphy and Judge Reinhold
to Danny Glover and Mel Gibson.
Mel Gibson, yeah. Like, you have to have this singular kind of pairing,
yeah,
of people,
like alchemy of just that, yeah,
that know who's gonna play which role. Where in Stakeout, these guys just don't quite gel and bounce off of one another like perfectly, because Dreyfus is playing against type. Instead of being the straight man, he's kind of the zany one,
hornball, weird,
and to where like Emilio Estevez should almost be like 15 years older than, yep, he is, and is the more experienced partner, to where like Richard Dreyfuss is supposed to be like, you just said, the hornball who's like out there trying to like bang suspects and stuff, and you watch it and you're like, ugh, this doesn't really work, because it's just Emilio trying to rein Richard Dreyfuss in. And this is something I brought to you kind of offline before we started recording, is that Stakeout is almost like the template for what Richard Linklater and Glenn Powell would do with Hitman.
Yeah.
Because there are scenes from it that are damn near identical.
Like beat for beat.
Like, am I wrong?
No. I don't want to speak for you, because the specific scenes, a lot of Hitman is, okay, I'm having a relationship with this woman,
and who's a suspect
who people are listening to, but I can't let on that it's me meeting with her, playing this role still. And this is very similar in that, you know, Richard Dreyfuss very early on, it's Madeline Stowe across the street from them. They're waiting, they're watching her to see if her ex-boyfriend Aidan Quinn, an escaped convict, will come back. And while doing it, Dreyfuss very quickly crosses the line and is like, I'm going to go into her house. He strikes up a relationship with her. But then it's
becomes... But you don't blame him, because Madeline Stowe in this movie is fucking smoking
hot. And she's great.
I mean, she always is, but in this one in particular, you're like, good lord, yeah,
this,
sir.
This and like Blink, also with Aidan Quinn.
Well, Unlawful Entry was the other one I was thinking of. Where grown men were coming up to me in the streets being like, sir, Madeline Stowe, would you or wouldn't you?
But, you know, with this, like I said, it's a scene, you know, that one of the best scenes from Hitman is this whole, you know, he knows they're being listened to by the surveillance crew from the police. And it's like, I need to give you information, but not, like, let them know that that I'm talking to you right now and that we're on the same side. And this is a very similar thing of, like, he strikes up a relationship with her and she's calling him at home, but her phone is being surveilled and is being tapped. So they're going to hear his voice, who's, you know, one of their team, speaking. And so he has this whole thing of, like, oh, I can't talk right now. And it works. The film is really uneven.
It's also too long.
It's way too fucking long. And again, even I think, like, you, it's one of those films also that does not age well at all, because literally the whole time, again, hornball Richard Dreyfuss, like, he literally breaks into her house while she's in the shower. And it's just like, this is not going to fly.
Yeah, but also one of the best scenes in the whole movie is when he breaks into her house to stop another guy,
yeah,
who's drunkenly accosting her and talks him down off the ledge. And like that scene, that's the thing, is that this is a 2-star movie with 4-star scenes.
Yeah. And John Seale shot it.
And it's also directed by John Badham.
Yeah, the fucking,
who,
I mean,
we made Saturday Night Fever.
And we did the Dracula episode.
Exactly.
A great adaptation.
Like, he's a good director. So like, this is a great example how, like, in the 80s, even our shittiest movies, our 2-star movies, are better than the Netflix fucking drivel that we get today, because every weekend in the summer in 1987, you were practically getting a new buddy cop movie.
Yep.
Directed by a good-ass filmmaker. And you're just sitting there being like, why can't we do that today? Oh, that's right. Because the Russo brothers can fucking suck my dick. But Young Guns is sort of similar in the same way because it feels like an action programmer that, by today's standards, would just be a Netflix pilot.
Yep. This film, out of every, you know, modern film-wise, reminds me the most of the Magnificent Seven remake.
Yeah, that's a good call.
Both of us, the kind of thing that you and
not I... Not as good, though. I actually like the Magnificent Seven remake, but I've been pushing for an Antoine Fuqua episode forever, and you've been, you know, resistant because don't know great cinema.
I know. I'm just a huge piece of shit is my main problem.
I mean, come on, man.
It's true. But in the sense that, and that film aside, one of the things you and I agreed together on off mic was Young Guns is all these people playing dress up, right?
Sure.
That the thing about rewatching this movie is, first of all,
it's the Halloween adventure version of a Western.
Well, this was the film that got, it's probably the first Western I ever saw, like straight up as a kid. I think I saw Young Guns 2 first because it was PG-13.
Sure. And the original. And the Bon Jovi song.
Yep. And the original was rated R. And I finally saw the first one. And it's a really breezy, kind of entertaining, not too far off from like the vibes of like Silverado. Which I much prefer.
Or honestly, the other one is that it kind of. I was gonna say it kind of kicks off the late '80s, early '90s Western craze that Tombstone
and Wyatt Earp.
Into.
Yeah,
Wyatt Earp is different because that has the Costner factor.
Yeah, and the Costner
still
in from,
like
yeah.
Costner's still behind. Like Kasdan made that movie, but like. Costner is like, what if it was 9 hours long? And yeah. Kasdan's like, sure, why not? We're like, Tombstone feel like if you were to do a double feature of Young Guns and Tombstone, it would feel more apt.
Well, they're both like big. They're
popcorn movies.
What's great about both is they're not Westerns. They are
anachronistic.
They're Hollywood action films with a Western paint job.
Yeah. Right? With great cast.
But the thing about specifically Young Guns, though, is like, here's this cast of, you know, Emilio, Kiefer Sutherland, Dermot Mulroney, Charlie Sheen, Casey Cizmico, and that's the main. Oh, and Lou
Jack
Diamond.
Palance.
And Jack Palance. Well, but for the young guys. And then Lou Diamond Phillips, right? Yeah. And all of these guys had, I think besides Dermot Mulroney, had their moments in some sort of leading role. This is, I believe, after La Bamba, you know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you're right.
And so all of them are being kind of like put in this ensemble film. And it's funny because looking back at us talking about St. Elmo's Fire is so many films. It's funny they called it the Brat Pack is so many films were ensemble films. There were a lot of them, I feel like, of like, let's pack as many people we can into one movie.
Well, let's unpack that a bit.
Yeah.
Because I feel like if we're going to transplant that into 2020s or even 2010s vocabulary cinematically, is that the 80s are almost the template for what like the Avengers era of cinema
but
was trying to replicate because it was always about... It wasn't about the movie star. That's the thing that we talk about a lot today in the age of like the MCU and everything is that there's no modern movie stars anymore. It's because everybody works in an ensemble. Like even people like Tom Cruise and Will Smith, they're essentially the residue of another era that's kind of left on a decade that is defined by collectives. And I feel like the Brat Pack era is the one, like the Rat Pack was there, but that one didn't in the 60s and early 70s. Yeah, that was the thing. Well, and also, like, half of those guys were already known for music. They weren't known for cinema. You know, like Sammy Davis Jr. and Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin were, like, they were all known for either music or comedy or, like, another facet of performance, to where the Brat Pack is almost the template for what the Disney MCU era is trying to replicate, and that it's like, it's not about the individual, it's about this group of people that you sign up for every time you go to a movie. And like, that's what's kind of crippled the modern movie star, is that you're not going to watch one person anymore. You're not like, even the 90s gave us Will Smith with like the Bad Boys movies and Independence Day in specific.
And Cruz, the continuation.
And like Cruz continued to kind of ride out his post Top Gun, Cocktail, and 80s kind of run. But like the 2000s were replicating what the Brat Pack sort of started, in that you're going to watch the Avengers assemble, as opposed to like nobody. And I feel like that's one of the weird things, that the more I think about Andrew McCarthy's documentary Brats, and what's kind of the fault in his central thesis, is that it's like he gets mad at being part of the Brat Pack, but at the same time, without the Brat Pack, nobody would give a fuck about Andrew McCarthy.
Well, and good points all. And I, two quick things though. One, in addition to the ensemble nature of MCU films in particular, one of the things I was reading this article about is it's also that the downfall of the movie star is its IP, right? So Chris Evans isn't a star. Captain America's a star.
Well, and it's also kind of the thing is that like everybody's trying to make Glenn Powell into the modern version of the movie star. But the thing is, like, what are the major Glenn Powell movies outside of Anyone But You?
Yeah.
Top Gun, Twisters, and now he's going to be in a reboot of Backdraft.
Yep. And Running Man.
And Running Man, is that without IP, you don't have Glenn Powell.
Yeah.
So that's what kind of makes him seem... I tweeted something like this and got a little bit of pushback, but I maintain it, is that like without IP, Glenn Powell seems kind of juiceless in a way.
Well, and to the original idea you said about, you know, like, who would Andrew McCarthy be without this, like, kind of collective? This, what I think about in the 90s as the definition of, like, the kind of continuation of that is Miramax and Dimensions horror films.
Sure.
Because like, Scream, and you think about now, even today, this idea of these CW actors.
Well, that's where I was going to go beyond even together. The Miramax stuff, is the CW-ification of like Dawson's Creek, Gossip Girl, all of those kind of teen to early 20-something shows, My So-Called Life, stuff like that, to where it's like people emerged from ensemble pieces as opposed to just defining themselves as individuals, and that's where the death of the movie star kind of began.
Yeah, Joshua Jackson never really had a huge leading role, but he was in a lot in bit parts or a little bit bigger parts in a lot of these neo slashers.
Well, and also, like, would we give a fuck about Neve Campbell if it wasn't for Scream?
Yeah.
And I don't mean that as, like, Neve Campbell's great in these movies, but, like, without Courtney Cox and David Arquette and Rose McGowan, like, and Jamie Kennedy, like, that's, we remember the core group of people as much as we recall Sydney.
Well, and just think about the way these films were advertised. Like, the covers for all of these, like,
were floating heads.
And it was like, hey, you know that person from here. So they were basically throwing a lot of pickles at the wall to pull from, you know, Billy Madison, and which one's going to stick. And it was pull from every show you've watched on CW or Party of Five on Fox or whatever. And we're going to put their faces on, and hopefully you recognize someone. And, you know, we'll put Drew Barrymore, for those of you who wants them a little bit older.
Exactly.
You know?
But yeah, like the Brat Pack article and the Brat Pack kind of cinema and these 80s collectives that were born from John Hughes sort of changed the way that we looked at cinema.
Yeah.
From that point forward, because it no longer became about, like, there were no more Paul Newmans. There were no more Robert Redfords. There were, because every now and again you had a Tom Cruise or a Will Smith.
Yeah.
Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
You know, like these, George Clooney.
Honestly, Denzel.
But even George Clooney too, emerged yeah. from TV.
Yep.
Denzel.
Yeah.
Denzel being like.
The definition.
Let's be real. If there was like a badder motherfucker and badder movie star in our lifetime, I can't think of it
yeah.
in Denzel. But they were rare.
Yeah.
Like the majority of the people who shined as individuals emerged or were at least bolstered by collectives and ensembles.
Well, even Will Smith, like, while he was big, his tenure of, like, those couple summers was, like, what, 4 years of, like, him owning 4th of July? It's not as long as we remember. I'm just trying to say.
Half a decade,
but I'm
bro.
Saying when you're comparing it to, like, what you're saying, though, 50s and 60s and 70s, these people who had longevity. I'm not trying to take away from Will Smith's star power, and I love Will Smith, but I'm talking about that.
I mean, we're still watching Bad Boys movies in the year of our Lord 2024.
Oh, he's great.
And loving them.
No, I'm a fan, but I'm just saying, like, he's a movie star, but again, like, you don't have the...
But then again, the Bad Boys movies are playing on the buddy cop formula we're talking about
yeah.
from the 80s, is that without stuff like 48 Hours, Beverly Hills Cop, Lethal Weapon, you don't have Bad Boys. You don't have Will Smith and Martin Lawrence.
Yeah.
You want to get to questions?
Let's do it.
All right. Questions about Emilio Estevez's career. Martin.
Yes.
Who the greatest Nepo baby of all time?
Nick Cage.
Motherfucker, you stole my goddamn cake.
That or Lily Rose Depp. It's.
I mean, it's, Nick Cage was my answer.
Yeah,
like, there's no, yeah, yeah. It has to be a, if you don't do Nick Cage, so if you do Nick Cage, then I'll do Sofia Coppola.
Yeah.
Because it has to be a Coppola child,
or,
right?
Or Ray J.
Who?
Brandy's brother who did the sex tape with Kim Kardashian.
No, no. Nope.
Brandy's a movie star again.
She is, because she's in that movie where the grandma's the racist.
The Front Room.
Is that what it's called?
The Front Room.
We saw that trailer together before Maxine?
Oddity.
Oddity. And you were like, this looks like the worst movie of all time. And I was like, I will be there at 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
My
on
name
Friday.
Is Belinda. Belinda.
It is, if we're being honest, like a great premise for a movie that will probably be a giant piece of shit.
Yeah. But I agree, like Cage and Sophia are, well, Cage in particular, because he tried to hide it for so long. You know, like changing his name early on. But he also was in his uncle's movies. I mean, like, he's in
Rumblefish.
Rumblefish. And then also a main role in Peggy Sue Got Married, like the second lead.
Yeah, he's the husband. And that movie rules. And he's great in it.
He's so weird in it.
Yeah, he's doing a full Nick Cage thing.
Yeah, squeaky voice, like, strange fucking movie. But Sophia,
wait,
like,
are you anti Peggy Sue Got Married?
I'm not a big fan.
That's fucking stupid.
Well, and you'd think it's my kind of movie, like this, like 1950s.
Yeah, time travel.
Yeah, like I don't hate it. I just
I don't like that opinion.
I know. Well,
it's bad.
It's the correct one, but we can.
Jeez, correct. All right, next question. Joe Estevez or Frank Stallone?
So it's really hard because
it's not hard.
No, well, it's Joe Estevez.
No, it's not.
Yeah. Have you watched?
No, it's Frank Stallone.
Have you watched the
political opinions aside?
No, the Decker series from Tim Heidecker.
No.
So Joe Estevez plays the president of the United States and he's going, it's delightful.
But have you ever listened to Frank Stallone's music?
Well, yeah, and also Frank Stallone, also on Tim and Eric, does a song where he sings to his daughter, goes, "We turned your bedroom into the computer room."
Yeah.
And it's just, it's good shit. I think both of them are definitely cool with
their image.
Their image and the fact that, like, they're the brother of. But Frank Stallone was bigger first. That's the thing people forget. Like, he had a little bit of a career before Sylvester. Like, people are like, oh, it's your brother, the actor kind of thing. And then, of course, Sylvester blew up.
Sure.
Yeah.
But, I mean, like, Frank Stallone also was brought along with his brother. That's the thing, is that, like, what we didn't touch upon is that even though Emilio's a Nepo baby, he's still, like, Young Guns. He co-stars with Charlie Sheen.
And Kiefer.
Wisdom.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Charlie Sheen makes a cameo. What's Kiefer got to do with this shit?
Also, Nepo Baby.
Well, I know. Well, what? Yeah. But he's Canadian. Does it count?
The border just leaves all the Nepo Baby energy.
Exactly.
North
of
the border. Yeah. Cool.
It's like, does anybody remember that he's actually Donald Sutherland's son?
Honestly, it is one that you kind of forget.
Exactly.
He's had his own, especially with 24. Like, I don't ever think of Jack Bauer and be like, oh, that's the guy. His dad was in Animal House.
And also Lost Boys, same year, 87, as Wisdom. And also, like, I guess Wisdom's 85, but, like,
86.
Same year as Stakeout. So, like, Kiefer's out there. He's in these streets. He's sucking blood. Being weird, having drinking problems, you know, like, you can't really say.
Also, Lost Boys, talk about another ensemble movie. Like, of just, like, from the Coreys to Jason Patrick, Kiefer, you know, the fucking Alex Winter, everybody.
So, next question. Did Charlie Sheen have the career that Emilio Estevez should have had?
I think so. I think Charlie had a better action career in terms of he had more movies.
Well, he also starred in a Best Picture winner.
True.
So that helped.
Well, and he... I'll phrase it another way. Is Charlie a better actor?
Well, here's a better question. Is Charlie a better movie star than Emilio?
Yes.
Because, like, even though, you know, he's in a Best Picture winner, but then he goes on to basically be in a lot of, like, B movies, like Terminal Velocity.
That's the one I kept thinking of, yeah.
The Wraith.
Yeah.
Like, The Chase is another one that's pretty good. Like, he kind of just worked.
Yeah.
Where Emilio, it's one of the things that, you know, the documentary Bratz goes into is that, and one of the most awkward interviews in the movie is Emilio and Andrew McCarthy is
bad news.
Talking about, like, how they thought that initial moniker stifled their ambitions is that Charlie seemed to not have any real ambitions beyond, like, I just want to act. I want to be a movie star. And I don't want to direct movies. I just want to be the guy in front of the camera who's handsome, gets the girl, kills the bad guy, and, you know, in the case of Terminal Velocity, you know, chases the car that's dropped out of the back of the plane. Like, it's, you know what I mean? Where Emilio, like, we make fun of Wisdom, but Wisdom is really riding on the coattails, in the Nepo Baby sense, of Martin Sheen's politics.
Yeah.
Is that it's all this, like, he adopted all of their dad's kind of political ambitions and being almost like an icon of, you know, the working man and leftist ideals, where like Charlie Sheen is like, I don't give a fuck. Just pay me the money, put me in a big movie, and let me fuck hookers, you know?
Well, I also like to think about their comedies, and two in particular, Hot Shots Part 1 and Part 2.
Oh, yeah, we haven't even gotten into that.
But that, and then Loaded Weapon. You know, you have two films that are full-up send-ups of action movies of the era, and, you know, it's funny, again, to have Stakeout same year, as you said, as Lethal Weapon, and then to have Loaded Weapon of him, he and Samuel L., you know, sending it up. And who does better? I think Charlie Sheen, like, is much better in that self-deprecating role because he was, like, he never had a sense of pretension about him.
I mean, you never saw Emilio Estevez in 2 and a Half Men.
Yeah. But I think it was like, to your point,
he's a workman,
right?
And it's also like it's not just a workman. It's also like he had a sense of humor about himself.
Yeah.
To where Emilio seemed like the guy who was like, I'm going to be the self-righteous, self-centered, kind of like political movie star, where Charlie Sheen is just like, what if I fired a chicken out of a bow and arrow?
You know, Emilio as a filmmaker, as a director and writer, reminds me most of James Franco, of making films like...
Oh, don't be that mean.
No, he's better, but like films in his version of...
And you know, I like James Franco.
But Sound and the Fury,
R.I.P.
Him doing Benji, Sound and the Fury, going full
Did
simple.
They ever have a funeral for James Franco? Is he buried somewhere?
I don't know. But...
Is he like Louis C.K.'s corpse where they're just like some random necrophiliacs just fucking it?
Keeping it slowly aroused.
Yeah, just pumping it full of fucking pervert semen.
But I do think that it is... Wisdom's messy. The way is messy. Also, again...
Men at work!
Yeah. But you have, again, you have, like, we were talking about, you know, you have Bobby, right?
And oh, my God.
Again, a very politically-minded movie, you know?
He had ambitions.
Yeah, huge ambitions. And, like,
he failed to meet them.
And Charlie, you know, like you said, with especially 2 and a Half Men, think about this: the same time that Emilio's making The Way with his dad about, like, father-son relationship stuff, Charlie's on 2 and a Half Men, playing a version of himself. We were talking about this last time, though, with, you know, Andrew McCarthy, but Rob Lowe, how his character on Parks and Rec is this almost forgiveness thing of, like, I'm going to lean into
an apology tour.
This, like, I'm this new goofy extra guy who's, like, a health nut. But Charlie went almost the other direction of, like,
I fuck hookers.
Well, I'm going to jokingly wallow in just me being, like, a scumbag.
Yeah.
You know, and it worked for a long time. The fact was, he is a scumbag. Like, it's like...
It's hard to talk about. Like, the thing is, we're joking, and it is funny, but, like, it actually is hard to talk about Charlie Sheen now because he's a bad person.
He is. Yeah, yeah.
He's done a lot of fucked up shit, and it's not funny anymore.
Exactly. We're well past that. Yeah.
So, speaking of well past things, fuck, marry, kill...
The old guys.
Harry Dean Stanton. Tom Skerritt. Jack Palance.
Okay, easy.
Is this easy?
Easy.
I don't know. I'm struggling.
No, you marry Harry Dean Stanton. It's the guy's a deep, he's a deep, deep man. You watch his interviews with him.
All these men are dead.
Yeah. So, but when they were alive. Wait,
Tom Skerritt might be
alive. He's alive. Yeah.
Harry Dean Stanton, definitely dead.
But he.
Jack Palance.
Dead.
Long dead. Tom Skerritt should be dead.
No, you marry. You easily marry Harry Dean Stanton.
You think so? Why is it? Go on.
Deep, meditative guy. You watch interviews with him. Best friends with David Lynch. Super, like, Buddhist, like, just really intelligent dude.
Also, Rebecca De Mornay said she would give up her whole life to be back with Harry Dean Stanton.
He's got that, like, Bill Hader energy.
He got that real dick.
Yeah. But I love him. And unironically, I just love him. And I
mean, he honestly, like, I brought up, I was having a conversation with somebody at work who is an aspiring actress. And I asked her, I was like, who's your favorite actor? And she gave me mine. And she asked me, she goes, who is yours? And I immediately spit out Warren Oates.
Yeah.
And then I thought about it later, and I was like, well, is Harry Dean Stanton actually my favorite actor? And then I went home and rewatched Paris, Texas, and like,
yep,
maybe that's the greatest male performance in the history of at least American cinema.
No, he's in the upper echelons. I would, oh man. Now, the hard decision is, do I fuck Tom Skerritt or do I fuck Jack Palance?
What if you get Eiffel Towered by both?
I mean, here's the thing. Tom Skerritt would be a very sensitive lover. He would be sweet and empathetic, and you feel very taken care of.
Oh, Jack Palance would stick three fingers in your asshole. No,
Palance would rip me in half.
Yeah.
And
he would probably spit on you.
No, he'd give it the hawk to. I mean, it'd be.
Oh, no, you're hawk-toing Jack Palance.
Yeah, that's true.
He's not sucking your dick.
So it really depends. I'm older now and I have different proclivities. I'm gonna fuck Tom Skerritt. I'm gonna kill Jack Palance.
I would marry Tom Skerritt. Because he's
also
a sensitive man.
Also a good answer.
I would fuck Jack Palance, but I'm the top. No. Let me walk this back. Maybe I would. Me and Harry Dean Stanton might fuck. Like a little bit. We'd be off and on again lovers. We'd switch.
Lovers.
But I'm killing Jack Palance.
Yep.
Like, he's too weird.
Yep.
Didn't he do push-ups on stage at the Oscars?
With one arm.
Yeah.
Give me Lieutenant Eckhart.
Yeah, if he's fucking you, you're getting gaped.
And you are my number one, a guy.
You, Martin, my bottom bitch. Prepare. To be Grand Canyon.
Jesus Christ. So for our audience, no more. We're making a pledge. No more mezcal before recording. This beautiful bottle of El Silencio. If you want to sponsor, we're open to it.
We might talk about fisting each other afterwards, but who knows? Martin, this has been great. Who for the Brat Pack is up next in our mini-series?
Mr. Rob Lowe.
Who's had his own weird, freaky sex stuff
but
that we've got to get into.
But we're going to talk about one of my favorites I've watched, Class, which is Andrew McCarthy from our first episode, and Rob Lowe. One of my favorite new watches of these movies, so I'm really excited to talk about it.
Plus, we also get one of the weirdest freaky sex movies, Bad Influence, with him and James Spader.
Which I've never seen.
Which is so much lecherous energy that the screen could almost not contain it. But you have to tune in next time to hear all about that on Secret Handshake. See you then.
Sponsored by El Silencio.
And my dick. Bye-bye.
Must have took a wrong.